continue the afternoon session and we've gone through the as examples of the five forest tradition of Ajahn Mun, Ajahn Mahabua, Upasika Ki, and the next sort of flavor that I'd like to present. All of these, the first three teachers are kind of like primary teachers and they've all passed away, so that the next teacher that I would like to introduce is Ajahn Liam, who is a the abbot of Wat Pho Phong, successor to Ajahn Chah as the abbot of Ajahn Chah's monastery, and he is he went to live with Ajahn Chah in 1969. That was, but it was already his ninth year as a monk when he didn't ordain with Ajahn Chah. And but he went to train with Ajahn Chah, and his account of his well, I'll have Ajahn Kurundamo do a reading, but his account of his practice with Ajahn Chah, I think, is helpful as a follows some of the important and central characteristics of the, again, the flavor and the way of training within the Thai forest tradition. And and some people who are here have met Ajahn Liam, and, so that it's not an, I think it's important to recognize that the tradition is not just some historical anomaly that is in the realm of mythology and fairy tale, but it's something that is carried on in contemporary times and is being passed on, so that I think Ajahn Liam really kind of exemplifies a good example of somebody who has experimented with his training, and then he gives examples of that, but then is also example to other people, so that certainly the in Thailand, his duties are it's hard to imagine for any of us to imagine of how much he actually does, because he's really the abbot of Wat Pho Phong, which has 40-50 monks, 40-50 nuns. But then Wat Pho Phong is the central monastery for about 300-400 other monasteries that are associated with that. So any problem comes up and they all come to him. And then of course he's actually he's always been very close to the Westerners. He and Ajahn Sumedho were very good friends when they were young monks together, and so that he's provided leadership and guidance over all this time. And of course, when the heck was it when just this last visit, he was at the meeting. There's this whole series of meetings that we had in England that myself and Ajahn Brichar were just at. And Ajahn Liam was there, and Ajahn Sujito, before the meetings actually started, he sat down and was talking with, took the opportunity to talk with Ajahn Liam, and kind of asked him, because, what's the role of the abbot? How do you hold this position of abbot? And Ajahn Liam sort of, abbot doesn't do anything. You don't have to do anything. You you practice and live, and you just respond to things. Wanted a job description. And then Liam wasn't really buying into it. He wasn't. What's important is kind of just living the life of a practitioner and trying to do it as best you can. There's nothing complicated. I think that's how he relates to practice, that's how he relates to duty. And he's incredibly at ease in the realm of all of this responsibility and projection. And I think it's a wonderful example of what's possible with the teachings and the effect that it has, because he's in the middle of all of this duty and projection or whatever, what comes his way. He doesn't pick up any of it. So it's quite delightful to be around him. So anyway, I think Kurundamo can do some readings.
This being the one that's quite long, maybe abbreviated a little
See where it goes, see what we're doing for time.
Yeah, there's a couple of places in the middle that I thought maybe I'd summarize or
read through.
My practice developed steadily throughout the second and third month of the Rains Retreat. With the beginning of the second month, some of the things that occurred seemed quite good. Good, in quotes. Here, meaning some parts good and others not so good. I noticed in myself that sometimes I felt good about things and sometimes not. So I asked myself, why are there always these states of good and bad? I posed this question to myself and realized it's because if one likes things being a certain way, one calls them good. And if one doesn't, one calls them bad. Are only the things one likes right and all the others wrong? What I did was question and investigate myself in order to get to know what desire really was. The ways desires express themselves are characterized by these feelings of good and bad. Feelings of good and bad arise from wanting. So I concluded, why bother with these feelings of good and bad? One should take the attitude of not getting involved with these things at all. What one should really take on is the practice of simply having mindfulness in and of itself. So this was the motto I upheld and kept bringing to practice. At the beginning of the second month, all my experiences were falling into place. I saw my own mental attitudes and knew the state of mind I was in, both the good states of mind and the bad ones. I saw the states of mind in relation to the mind, and saw the mind in relation to the states of mind. In this matter, I saw that the mind, jit, was one thing, and the states of mind, arom, were another. Being able to distinguish the way one feels, separating states of mind from that which is the mind, and in this way knowing and seeing one's mind and one's state of mind as separate, one sees, quote, the one who knows. Sees the one who knows the mind and who knows the states of mind. This made me experience everything that was happening in a wakeful manner, feeling aware and alert, both when I was sleeping and awake. I was witnessing my own experience all by myself. It was not as if I were escaping to some other place or being aloof, but instead I was following up on things all the time, both the good experiences and the bad ones. That's the way I saw it. I didn't see this experience as anything particularly good. I simply understood it as something I did that was good enough for keeping myself alert. That was all. This experience reminded me of a passage of Dhamma. It made a strong impression on me when I studied for the NUCTOM exam. I have frequently mentioned it to you in the past. I learned many other passages, but this one I remember particularly well. It comes easily to mind. Whoever watches their mind will be free from Mara's snare. How does one become free from Mara's snare? By watching the mind. This is exactly what I thought, so I established my mindfulness in the observation of the modes of what I was feeling. At the same time, I continued to give attention to a samadhi object of meditation. It's not that I neglected this. It is necessary to hold on to a samadhi object as well. I didn't seek for anything more distant than the in and out breath. To watch the breath has an impact on the mind. It enables it to overcome defilements and cravings. I observe the samadhi object, and I observe the modes of the mind, both unwholesome and wholesome. Knowing the samadhi object and the modes of the mind, these two were joined together and didn't separate whether walking, standing, sitting, or lying down. There was the experience of awareness all the time. Sometimes there were states of depression and discouragement. This was also part of the experience. I thought, not facing any obstacles is impossible in this world. One cannot have everything go smoothly all the time. One has to bear with these obstacles. Whatever happens, one has to endure and pull oneself together. There is no other way. So I tried to be aware of this and patiently endure things. Sometimes I was overcome by the hindrances, Nivarana. They were quite strong. If one were to give a comparison, it was like being a football that is kicked around. When kicked hard, it shoots off quickly. I couldn't pin it down. The mind kept proliferating here and there, thinking about business, the chores, going on alms round. The mind was in such a state, but I actually didn't make much of it. I just saw that this is how it feels, and upheld that these are all just states of the mind that arise, stay a while, and then cease. I saw it as an experience, a symptom that the mind displays. Seeing how this feels in the mind, I thought, this is what the Buddha actually meant when he said, the mind is like that. It has to express good and bad. One can't blame it for this. One can't say that it's all bad. One can't say that it's all good. So I continued observing these things mindfully. If something came up that was really beyond my capacity to endure, I thought, it's anicca, dukkha, and anatta again. If one can't fight it anymore, one just tells oneself, anicca, dukkha, anatta. And let's go of it all, letting it be. So this is what I did. Sometimes it was good in that a feeling of inspiration and having patient endurance would arise from time to time. But I didn't make anything of it. I just considered that this was part of the back and forth of the struggle between coping and not coping. Then, after maintaining this practice for a continuous period, constantly and unremittingly, the various conditions eventually start making sense. The part that I'll kind of just summarize, he then went through a period of more intensified practice, taking what he just described to heart and really applying himself, maintaining his awareness and still experiencing feelings of darkness, depression, and other periods that were of happiness, but just keeping in mind this investigation that didn't take a preference over any of them, and constantly did that as much as he could through the day and in the evening. Lumpo Cha then announced that the monks and novices should have a break from morning and evening chanting. This came at just the right time for me. He reminded everybody that when there was no morning or evening chanting, they should spend their time like practitioners. Now there weren't any communal activities except for water hauling from the well, which we used to do in those days, hauling and carrying water together. I never spoke with anyone when carrying the water. When it was time, we would simply take the poles and tins for carrying, help each other fetch the water from the well, and then carry it to fill up the jars in the restrooms for flushing the toilets, or to fill up the drinking water. Afterwards, I would go have a shower at one of the bathing places, and would then carry on with walking or sitting meditation. At times, while I was doing walking meditation, it started raining, and I was tempted to stop. But then I thought, just let the rain rain. I will keep on walking. Things get wet, but they also become dry again. One shouldn't even be thinking about whether it is going to be sunny or rainy. I don't know where the faith I had came from. I had no worries about what was going to happen with me. I was fully dedicated and pleased with what I was doing. There was continuous interest and motivation. I didn't shy away from possible obstacles. I wouldn't question or analyze where I was at when I was doing walking meditation. Usually when doing walking meditation, I wouldn't wear my upper robe in the formal way, but would wear only the small shoulder cloth, angsa. But from time to time, I robed up completely, somehow afraid that my standards were insufficient, putting my upper robe and laying the outer robe over my shoulder. During this phase of practice, another change occurred. This change, speaking in proper scholarly terms, might be described as the experience of vipassana upakilesa, experiences which defile insight. I had a feeling of bliss and bright radiance within myself, lasting days and nights. The bright light is not like the light of the sun or any source of light, but it is something you feel inside that has these radiant qualities. I didn't get carried away with it, thinking that I was something special. I merely saw what happened as an experience within the practice, happening in and of itself. Things like this can happen. So, for my part, I determined to be mindful and not get lost identifying myself with being this or that. One harbors these feelings of self-importance. One is almost sure to go crazy from such an experience. This is what happens to some practitioners at this stage. They start feeling special and superior to others, seeing everybody else as inferior to themselves, for example. These feelings can occur, so I was determined to have mindfulness and awareness and not let myself get involved with feelings of wanting and giving things personal importance, constantly telling myself, experiences like this, having arisen, must cease again. I had mindfulness with regard to this and focused in this way on what I was experiencing day and night. These experiences can happen. The Buddha even gave them a name, defilements of insight, vipassana upakilesa. They all occur within the scope of vipassana. It seems like when one enters the realm of, quote, vipassana, one has to also enter the realm of vipassana upakilesa. That's the way things happen. But I didn't get lost or deluded. I didn't get carried away with myself. All I saw was a situation of arising, existence, and change. I still kept up all the daily routines. Most of the time when I sat down meditating, I didn't sit all that long. During this phase, I sat for only a bit more than an hour. This seemed to be conducive for my body, and I never had any physical problems, no pains or other frustrating symptoms. Not having health issues, one can practice with ease. I did not develop feelings of self-importance regarding the things that arose in my practice. I kept doing the communal chores, keeping to myself while doing the work, looking at my own mind, my own feelings, just the same as before. I was consciously aware of myself, observing, and trying to watch myself not only when I was awake, but also when sleeping. As I was practicing with unremitting effort, yet another change came. I reached a low and dark spot, feeling that I was under attack again. Sexual desires would flare up every now and again. Other than watching these symptoms suddenly come up, I didn't have any tools to add to my practice. These feelings were displaying themselves, but I didn't develop worries and concerns because of them. I simply stayed alert and was very careful. Whatever happened, one had to be careful, to be on the watch and always suspicious, just as though one were watching wild animals. One sits quietly and composed, as wild animals constantly run back and forth. I was always on the watch, not trusting the situation, in a way that kept me wide awake and well aware. Physically, this was actually quite tiring at times. I felt exhausted and weak. It was like constantly being in a state where there was no room for relaxation. But I kept doing the practice. Then, on one of those days, things changed again. They were perpetually changing anyway. Certain questions came up in my mind. The question arose, this practice, what do we do it for? I was stunned when the answer came, as if the silence itself was answering. This practice? No need to ask. We practice for the sake of practice. This is the way the answer came up. These words appearing, expressing something in a certain form, and there was nothing more to it.
Ajahn Niyam expressed there is another kind of central theme that comes up through the forest tradition of the being able to recognize the difference between the, you know, the mind itself and the moods of the mind or the objects of mind. And that's an important investigation and typifies a perspective that really helps to clarify the kind of the essence of the practice, because we tend to get entangled in the moods of the mind, the objects of the mind, and forget to come back to the mind itself, the heart itself. So that is a really helpful tool for kind of separating the wheat from the chaff, sort of thing. What's going on in our experience? Rick.
So, kind of listening to that, taking when he goes, he says, "Oh, practice is just for practice."
Yeah,
was kind of coming up for me. Anytime I put a meaning on practice, there has to be an ego state then arises around that meaning.
Yeah.
And then I can see the ego state wanting to protect my meaning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because then it becomes me practicing rather than practice.
Yeah, it's like letting go, even practicing with the idea that to become enlightened or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Just to practice.
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of the things that is expressed in the, that Ajahn Chah expressed really kind of clearly or succinctly in that film, The Mindful Way, and of that practicing for Nibbana is just another kind of desire. It's a very attractive desire, but it's an obstacle in itself.
In your earlier reading, Ajahn Mun, he mentioned primal mind.
Yes.
Is that what you're discussing here?
Yeah. It's expressed in a few different ways, but that's essentially what it is. It's sort of like a primal mind, the mind itself, original mind. There's all sorts of different ways that it's expressed, and there's a just wondering about, there's a wonderful exchange that it's right actually in here, where there's a series of questions and answers, and you know, something that you know, where yeah, it's like in a sense of this primal mind, original mind, the mind itself, sort of thing. There's this monk is asking these questions, and he's really trying to get it all clarified and laid out. And it seems as if you're saying there's something else outside of the conventional body mind, the five khandhas. Is there something else? What do you call it? Ajahn Chah's answer: there isn't anything, and we don't call it anything. That's all there is to it. Be finished with all of it. Even the knowing doesn't belong to anybody. So be finished with that too. Consciousness is not an individual, not a being, not a self, not an other. So finish with that. Finish with everything. There's nothing worth wanting. It's all just a load of trouble. When you see clearly like this, then everything is finished. Question. Could we not call it the original mind? You can call it that if you insist. You can call it whatever you like for the sake of conventional reality. But you must understand this point clearly. This is very important. If we didn't make use of conventional reality, we wouldn't have any words or concepts with which to consider actual reality. Dhamma. This is very important to understand. So it's sort of, yeah, we use these concepts, but you know, it's important to sort of, okay, what's the underlying feeling? So yeah, there's this primal mind or aspects of the mind that are kind of fundamental, the quality of knowing, and then there's this, the objects and moods of the mind and the movement of the mind, and we want to see that clearly, but then have a base to experience it from.
I really appreciate the line that was read said out. I didn't make much of it. You know, I noticed these mind is in such a mood. And I find that so ironic, because another time I said, you know, but the samadhi object of concentration, the breath, it's this contradiction between being very active and not being active at the same time.
Yeah.
So just hear that again.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a it's a really important aspect in the sense of I think Ajahn Liam expressed it very nicely, where you don't let go of that samadhi object. You want to refine awareness. You want to refine concentration. You want to be able to clarify the ability of the mind to be still and be sharp and in focus, but then you can't obsess over it, you can't make much of it in the sense of and whatever arises from that, and just sort of seeing how the mind wants to grasp, or the value that it puts on it, or the projection that it starts to move towards, and it's in that way that we start to see the kind of limitations of the conceptual mind, there's the work that needs to be done, and you can't neglect it, and you can't make the mind just relinquish and let go. So it's this gradual process of caring for the mind, looking after it, and things start to settle and So again, I think it comes back to the quality of trust and on a certain level, devotion. Devotion, trust, faith.
Am I understanding correctly that his focus was mindfulness of breathing,
yeah,
but he was also aware of the moods of the mind,
yeah,
passing through and sometimes get kicked around by the hindrances?
Yeah. And he's, I mean, it's nice of him being. And I think that's something that the many of the forest monks, but particularly Tenzin Chan, Kosajan Lien, as a student, you know, quite clear of the fact of there's obstacles, there's hindrances, there's defilements that come and overwhelm the mind. And it's not ever onward and upward,
mm-hmm,
kind of progression to Nibbana. And say, there's lots of things that you have to weave your way through. And you have to be patient with the obstacles that the mind throws up. There's a, I'll continue on. There's a couple of readings that I'm not going to get to, which I really didn't expect we were going to get all the readings done. But I think we should, it'd be kind of nice to maybe post these up onto our website for people to access at some point. There's a book, and actually there's another piece that was recently put up as an introduction to Ajahn Brecha. And there's a book that was done, that's a couple years ago now, but what it was Ajahn, or one of the senior monks, had either himself or a group of lay people go and do short interviews with all of the senior teachers within the Ajahn Chah tradition. It's in, of course, it's in Thai. It's like Ye Thich, beautifully illustrated, nicely done volume. But there's not much of it in English, right? but actually Kovilo here has, in as a part of his learning Thai language, has been translating a few of them, and there's a piece of with an interview with Ajahn Brecha that's on our website right now, and is very interesting, giving his experience of being with Ajahn Chah. And then there's a couple more here that would be, I think, quite nice to put up and for people to see. One is by Senior Monk Ajahn Thun, and he's a monk who his family came from the same village that Ajahn Chah came from. So Ajahn Chah knew his parents and his aunts and uncles and brothers and sisters, so that he knew the whole family. And then when he came and ordained, they had moved away, and they were actually very wealthy landowners in an adjacent province. So he had a pretty comfortable upbringing, and he had a lot to go back to if he wanted to, as a layperson, if he left the robes. So that he found practice really difficult. He found training very difficult. And actually, for quite a few years, at the end of the rains retreat, it was almost turned into a ritual of Ajahn Thun coming with a tray of candles, incense, and flowers, with a set of, a little bag with his jeans and his t-shirt. Take leave of Ajahn Chah and to leave the ropes and go back to the go back to the world. And he said, I asked for Lumpacha for permission to disrobe many times. He would allow the other monks who came with me to disrobe, but not myself. He told me that we could talk with him a little while, and then asked the other monks who were there to go and join the chanting in the meeting hall. After that, he told me that I could go and give a massage at his kuti. I didn't know how to massage, and when I had finished, Lumpa said that it hurt worse than before. Then he gave me a dasana saying, "Can't you throw it away for just one lifetime? I'll help you throw it away. I've thrown it away just the same. Take this in exchange for your life. Hand over your body and life to the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Noble Sangha for just one lifetime. Throw everything else away and let the world have it." I just sat there listening with my hands in Anjali. Afterwards, he used a soft stick, saying, "You have to lure it as you would a small dog. If you still can't catch it, then toss a ball of rice at it, so that it will keep chasing after you. Then one day you'll be able to catch it." He compared it in this way. So it was just the kept... he said, Lumpa Cha would often mention Lumpa Tonrat and Lumpa Kinrali. These were Ajahn Chah's teachers, as examples of using strategy to subdue the defilements. He gave me the example of when Lumpa Tonrat wanted to disrobe. Lumpa Tonrat would go in the middle of the forest alone and cry out, "Come and look at the monk who wants to disrobe him." Finally, Lumpa Cha told me to walk Jonkro without stopping, walking meditation. Put forth effort without stopping. I held on to what he said and hid away to memorize the Padimokkha alone in the middle of the forest. Lumpa Cha gave me the name Venerable Burning Fire because my mind was hot. Even when I couldn't grab a foothold in meditation, I still forced myself to do it. Now that I'm more than 60 years old, things have become cool and I understand my debt of gratitude towards my teacher. He lured this little dog to the point where it was able to stay until the present day. I was just a little dog. Wherever I am, thinking of this, my tears flow. It's a very beautiful recollection of Ajahn Chah. That I remember Ajahn Thun talking about that, where sometimes he'd come with his trains, and sometimes Ajahn Chah would talk him out of it, sometimes he'd encourage him, sometimes he'd admonish him. He said, I come towards Ajahn Chah with my train, and I just about get to his kuti, he'd get up and walk away and disappear. For many monks who came like that, then he just give them encouragement, go back, keep the precepts. But he really felt that somebody like Ajahn Thun was somebody to try to keep in the robes, and he was able to do that. Kind of respect that Ajahn Thun had for him, he was able to get him through it. Now he's really one of the very respected senior teachers in the Ajahn Chah tradition. There's another one of Ajahn Tongchen, who's a contemporary of mine. He gives nice examples of stories of having just his relationship with Ajahn Chah, experiences he had. So I'll try to be nice to sort of clean it up and put it up onto the website. It could be nice for people to see. It's getting close to 4 o'clock, so we can do a final reading of Ajahn Chah, sort of to tie it together. And so this is from a talk that Ajahn Sumedho actually translated. It was one that he was really, it's the only talk I think that Ajahn Sumedho ever translated. It seemed to encompass all the different aspects of training and the flavor of that. So this is just a somewhat short, a few pages of excerpt. The way of developing the heart, as taught by the Buddha, is the exact opposite of the way of the world, because his teachings come from a pure heart. A pure heart, unattached to defilements, is the way of the Buddha and his disciples. If you practice the Dhamma, you must bow your heart to the Dhamma. You must not make the Dhamma bow to you. When you practice this way, suffering arises. There isn't a single person who can escape this suffering. So when you commence your practice, suffering is right there. The duties of meditators are to develop mindfulness, collectedness, and contentment. These things stop us. They stop the habits of the hearts of those who have never trained. And why should we bother to do this? If you don't bother to train your heart, then it remains wild, following the ways of nature. It's possible to train that nature so that it can be used to advantage. This is comparable to the example of trees. If we just left trees in their natural state, we would never be able to build a house with them. We couldn't make planks or anything of use in building a house. However, if a carpenter came along wanting to build a house, he would go looking for trees such as these. He would take this raw material and use it to advantage. In a short time, he could have a house built. Meditation and developing the heart are similar to this. You must take this untrained heart, the same as you would take a tree in its natural state in the forest, and train this natural heart so that it is more refined, so that it's more aware of itself and is more sensitive. Everything is in its natural state. When we understand nature, then we can change it. We can detach from it. We can let go of it. Then we won't suffer anymore. The nature of our heart is such that whenever it clings and grasps, there is agitation and confusion. First it might wander over there, then it might wander over here. When we come to observe this agitation, we might think that it's impossible to train the heart, and so we suffer accordingly. We don't understand that this is the way the heart is. There will be thoughts and feelings moving about like this, even though we are practicing, trying to attain peace. That's the way it is. When we have contemplated many times the nature of the heart, we will come to understand that this heart is just as it is and can't be otherwise. We will know that the heart's ways are just as they are. That's its nature. If we see this clearly, then we can detach from thoughts and feelings, and we don't have to add on anything more by constantly having to tell ourselves that that's just the way it is. When the heart truly understands, it lets go of everything. Thinking and feeling will still be there, but that very thinking and feeling will be deprived of power. This is similar to a child who likes to play and frolic in ways that annoy us, to the extent that we scold or spank them. We should understand that it's natural for a child to act that way. Then we can let go and leave them to play in their own way. So our troubles are over. How are they over? Because we accept the ways of children. Our outlook changes and we accept the true nature of things. We let go and our heart becomes more peaceful. We have right understanding. If we have wrong understanding, then even living in a deep dark cave would be chaos, or living high up in the air would be chaos. The heart can only be at peace when there is right understanding. Then there are no more riddles to solve and no more problems to arise. This is the way it is. You detach, you let go. Whenever there is any feeling of clinging, we detach from it, because we know that that very feeling is just as it is. It didn't come along especially to annoy us. We might think that it did, but in truth, It is just that way. If we start to think and consider it further, that too is just as it is. If we let go, then form is merely form, sound is merely sound, odor is merely odor, taste is merely taste, touch is merely touch, and the heart is merely the heart. It's similar to oil and water. If you put the two together in a bottle, they won't mix because of the difference of their nature. Oil and water are different in the same way that a wise person and an ignorant person are different. The Buddha lived with form, sound, odor, taste, touch, and thought. He was an arahant. So he turned away from, rather than toward, these things. He turned away and detached little by little, since he understood that the heart is just the heart, and thought is just thought. He didn't confuse and mix them together. The heart is just the heart. Thoughts and feelings are just thoughts and feelings. Let things be just as they are. Let form be just form. Let sound be just sound. Let thought be just thought. Why should we bother to attach to them? If we think and feel in this way, then there is detachment and separateness. Our thoughts and feelings will be on one side, and our heart will be on the other. Just like oil and water, they're in the same bottle, but they are separate. The Buddha and his enlightened disciples lived with ordinary, unenlightened people. They not only lived with these people, but they taught these ordinary, unenlightened, ignorant ones how to be noble, enlightened, wise ones. They could do this because they knew how to practice. They knew that it's a matter of the heart, just as I have explained. So, as far as your practice of meditation goes, don't bother to doubt it. If we run away from home to ordain, it's not running away to get lost in delusion, nor out of cowardice or fear. It's running away in order to train ourselves, in order to master ourselves. If we have understanding like this, then we can follow the Dhamma. The Dhamma will become clearer and clearer. The one who understands the Dhamma understands themselves. And the one who understands themselves understands the Dhamma. Nowadays, only the sterile remains of the Dhamma have become the accepted order. In reality, the Dhamma is everywhere. There is no need to escape to somewhere else. Instead, escape through wisdom, escape through intelligence, escape through skill. Don't escape through ignorance. If you want peace, then let it be the peace of wisdom. That's enough. Anybody have any questions? We're getting toward the end of the day. Yeah, Dee.
You mentioned a while ago a story about Ajahn Chah. He cultivated the Brahma Vihara Metta, I think, when you were talking to Ajahn Leo, because Ajahn Leo has all these responsibilities and duties, and Ajahn Leo acutely, or insight, has cultivated the Brahma Vihara of equilibrium. And as I've never met Ajahn Chah, it cast a very interesting light on his character, because, you know, he was a very strong person, but yet he cultivated deliberately the quality of loving kindness, which perhaps brought everybody in. I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, yeah, I mean, Yeah, I don't know that how conscious it was, but certainly his being manifested loving kindness and exemplified that quality of metta. And that was always the feeling that one had drawing close to him, that he had tremendous loving kindness and compassion to people. He always had kind of time, he always had this warmth that drew people in. People felt comfortable with him, drawn to his warmth. Different people have different characters or different personalities. And Ajahn Liam has a bit more of an aloof personality, and his sort of take on it, his kind of wry comment of saying, I just kind of stating, oh yeah, Ajahn Cha had tremendous loving kindness, and his sort of his spiritual faculty, the barmy of loving kindness was really full. He said, and then he said, lots of loving kindness, that's really tiring. I'm putting more attention on equanimity. Papu Beka. It was a certain wry comment. And difference of temperament, the difference of focus. But I think it's important to recognize that these different teachers and practitioners that have experienced some kind of accomplishment, they're not cookie cutter personality types. They cover a whole range of being, and I think it's helpful to to see the different types of people who are accomplished teachers, and recognize that one doesn't have to try to be something that one isn't. One of the quotes that I really like is from the Hasidic tradition of a renowned Hasidic teacher, Susya, he once said that in teaching, he said, when I die and I'm meet my maker, God won't ask me, why were you not more like Moses? He'll ask me, why were you not more like Susya? And so it's like, it's not about trying to be something you aren't. It's really learning how to understand how to be who you are. Yes.
How is one clinging to personality?
How?
You're being who you are, but then there's some sense of clinging.
Well, then as soon as you cling, then you'll suffer. So that there's an ease, in the sense of, as soon as you start forming an identity of I am, say, I am equanimous, or I am compassionate, or I am angry and wrathful, or I am helpful. You know, as soon as whatever you create as an I am position, there's inherent suffering in that. But it doesn't mean that people are, that there's no personality or it's like, you know, even in the Buddha's time, all these different great disciples of the Buddha had very different temperaments, Ananda was always considered, you know, kind and mindful. Sariputta was the guru, the wise, incisive, discerning. Mahamoggallana was the you know, this incredible psychic powers the same on the Bhikkhuni, the nun side, and you know, different these great disciples had different characteristics. There's a great story toward the end of the Buddha's life. There was this bit of a conflict, and there's a bit of a thing happening, and Ananda was kind of complaining to the Buddha that, you know, Aniruddha, who was the foremost in the refined states of meditation and his ability to communicate with other worlds and other beings. And he's also the Buddha's cousin. Aniruddha was. And so was Ananda. But so he's this great, incredible meditator. But then Ananda's complaining, you know, there's some of these monks and they're, you know, Aniruddha's around and he's not really training them properly, and they're getting into conflict. And the Buddha just sort of says, when did Aniruddha ever pay attention to, you know, to looking after people in that way? And he's just not, you know, sort of basically, he's just never been practical. You know, why do you expect him to be so now? So his personality wasn't great in leadership. So he's an incredible meditator. Okay, let's wind it up with a period of sitting. We've had the opportunity to hear for so many teachings. But it's always good to bring it back to our own experience, our own heart.